Welcome to our Bible study tonight of the Gospel of Mark. We hope everything is going well at your home and that you are well. We're continuing in our study of the Gospel of Mark using our Bible correspondence course written by Gary Fisher. You can sign up for that if you'd like it at eastside-church.org. Just go to our website, click on Study at Home banner, and you can sign up for the course. And we've been studying this now for several weeks. We're in chapters 13 and 14 tonight. This is lesson 9 in the series of studies. We have one more lesson to go before we finish out our study of the Gospel of Mark together. So I encourage you, if you're following along at home, to get your Bible and open up to Mark chapter 13. We've been looking at a number of things that Jesus has said and done in the last week of his life before his crucifixion. And now we're going to be looking at the last couple of days before he's arrested and then crucified. So we pick up events in Mark chapter 13, and we're calling this lesson the final teachings of Jesus. Obviously, he taught his disciples after his resurrection, and he taught through them as well. But as far as before his crucifixion, these would be the final things that he taught and did with his disciples. So in Mark chapter 13 and verse 1, as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be overthrown." As we look at Mark 13, let's think about how this is going to progress and give you just a real quick overview of what Jesus is going to be teaching about. This is the longest single section of Jesus' teaching found in the Gospel of Mark. There are about 34 of the 37 verses where Jesus is speaking directly. And most of it is going to be about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem and the destruction of Jerusalem itself, verses 1 through 31. And then Jesus will also say some things, I believe, about the end of time. Verse 30 will be the break point between those two events, between talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of time. We'll see that when we get there in just a minute. So the destruction of Jerusalem, of course, is a critical point in biblical history. It was prophesied, and here it's being prophesied by Jesus. It's an important fact of history, certainly for the Jews. In this event, which would happen about 35 years or so after Jesus prophesied it, God's power and purpose for punishing disobedient Israel are going to be clearly seen. And Jesus' foreknowledge of the event truly demonstrates him to be the Son of God. A couple of other things about the destruction of the temple is that as the disciples point out these stones that Jesus, and they have been looking at it, admiring, Jesus says that not one of those stones is going to be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. This is all going to be destroyed, he's saying. And on the Mount of Olives then, just a little bit later, in verses 3 and 4, he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. Then Peter, James, and John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled?" And they want to know when this is going to happen. When will the temple be destroyed? When will Jerusalem be destroyed? Jesus is sitting on the Mount of Olives. And from the Mount of Olives, you could have just looked right across the valley, the Kidron Valley, and seen the temple. In fact, at one point, you could have looked straight into the Holy of Holies if the door was open, depending on where they were on the Mount of Olives. So this discourse of Jesus, sometimes called the Olivet Discourse because it was on the Mount of Olives, again, mainly having to do with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and then also talking some about his second coming. But Jesus warns of a number of coming events. The temple was, at this period of time, undergoing major reconstruction. It had been begun by Herod in about 20 BC. In John chapter 2 and verse 20, the Jews say that at that point, when they were discussing with Jesus, that it had been building for 46 years. It would go on for another 20 years or so. It wasn't really finished even when Jesus walked in it. The temple was made of huge stones. Josephus, who was a Jew, who later wrote Jewish history for the Romans, walked in that temple, saw it being destroyed according to his own testimony. But he says that the temple was built of hard white stones, each of which was about 25 cubits in length. That's over 37 feet long and 8 cubits in height. That's 12 feet high. So huge stones weighing many tons. And so it was truly a marvelous bit of architecture. And it's no wonder that the disciples admired it. But Jesus is more interested in letting them know about its coming destruction. No doubt it was a beautiful place physically, but it was going to be destroyed, and it was going to be destroyed because of the Jews' disobedience to God. And so we continue on, Mark chapter 13 and verse 5. Jesus answers their question. He says, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and will deceive many." So Jesus is going to warn of coming events that are not necessarily indicative of the temple about to be destroyed. He's saying there are a number of things that are going to happen. These are not signs that the temple is going to be destroyed. These are not signs that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. So don't take them to be signs. But here are some things that are going to happen between, you know, when he's speaking that time there and when it is destroyed. So he says, one of the things that's going to happen is there'll be false Christs that will arise. People will come and say that they are the Christ. And Jesus says, don't be deceived by that. Don't be led astray by that. And then he says in verse 7, when you hear wars and rumors of wars, do not be troubled, for such things must happen. The end is not yet. So again, there are going to be wars. There are going to be all sorts of things going on in the world. That doesn't mean the temple is going to be destroyed or the end of time is coming or anything. That's just a part of the process of things. Nations are going to rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines and troubles. These are the beginning of sorrows. So that's not, you know, what Jesus is talking about as far as the destruction of the temple is concerned. There will be all kinds of things that are going on before it comes, but just because these things happen doesn't mean that the destruction of the temple is imminent. But he says in verse 9, "Watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you to councils. You will be beaten in the synagogues. You will be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all the nations." Jesus is plainly saying the disciples are going to suffer persecution, and the gospel is going to be preached to the whole world. Again, that's going to happen before the destruction of Jerusalem would occur. The Apostle Paul, writing to the Colossians in Colossians chapter 1, in verses 5 and 6, and also in verse 23, indicates that at that time when he wrote to the Colossians in the 60s AD, that the gospel had been preached to the world according to the instructions of Christ. He says in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 5 about the truth of the gospel, he said, "As it has come to you, as it has to the whole world," or in all the world. And in Colossians 1 and verse 23, he speaks about the hope of the gospel, which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven. So Paul asserts that the gospel by the early 60s AD had been preached to the whole world. Of course, the temple in Jerusalem wasn't destroyed till 70 AD. So certainly Jesus' prophecy there about the gospel first being preached to the whole world came true. And then he talks about how the apostles would receive divine help from God as they suffered persecution and went about preaching the gospel. He says in verse 11, "When they arrest you and deliver you up, do not worry beforehand or premeditate what you will speak. But whatever is given you in that hour, speak that, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit." Now, please notice, this is a promise that's given specifically to the apostles for the time frame in which the gospel was first being preached to the whole world. These men had the ability to perform miracles. They would be baptized in the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. So these were Jesus' special messengers. He says to them, "Brother will betray brother to death, a father his child. Children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end shall be saved." So these are some of the things that are going to happen before the temple would be destroyed. And then he gets to the point in verse 14 where he talks about, okay, now here are the things to look for. where you know it's about to be destroyed. He says, so when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So what Jesus says is, when you see this abomination of desolation, something that was prophesied about in Daniel, Daniel chapter 9, chapter 11, chapter 12, have reference to this. And if you go and read the prophecies of Daniel, we won't take the time to do that tonight, but it's apparent that the abomination of desolation is a foreign army that invades Jerusalem and overwhelms the temple. Without saying much more about that, that's indicated in the prophecies in Daniel. So he says, when you see that about to happen, get out of Dodge. That's the time to leave. Flee, because then the destruction is near. He goes on and explains to them that they need to go quickly to a place of safety, and that there's going to be difficulty in travel at that time. He gives them all sorts of warnings and heads up, really, about what's going to happen. He says in verse 15, let him who is on the housetop not go down into the house, nor enter or take anything out of the house. Let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in the winter. So it would be a difficult flight to escape the invading armies and to get out of Jerusalem before it was surrounded and besieged and the temple was destroyed. It's interesting that history tells us that many, many Jews were killed in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Josephus says it was over 1 million Jews that either died of starvation or slaughter from the Romans. But we have no record, I don't know of any at least, of any Christians being put to death in Jerusalem at that time, because they heeded the warning of Jesus. It pays to pay attention to Jesus. These warnings were given to people who believed Jesus' words, and they believed Jesus' words, and they saw this coming, and they got out of town in time. Jesus says that the tribulation is going to be the worst that's ever seen. In verse 19, in those days there will be tribulation such as not been since the beginning of the creation, which God created until this time, nor shall ever be. Unless the Lord had shortened those days, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, whom he chose, he shortened the days. As I said, Josephus said over 1 million Jews were killed during the siege of Jerusalem. And he also wrote about it, and I'll just quote this historian who lived to see it, was an eyewitness, I believe, of the event. He said, no other city ever suffered miseries, nor did any age from the beginning of the world ever breed a generation more fruitful in wickedness than this was. And he also says, if the miseries of all mankind from the creation were compared, those which the Jews then suffered, they would appear inferior. So it was also Josephus' estimation, who saw the destruction of Jerusalem, that it was the worst thing that ever happened to anybody in the history of the world. It's an interesting assessment, and it does seem to fulfill, does it not, the very prophecy, the very words of Jesus about the destruction of Jerusalem. Again, Jesus warns about false Christs and false prophets. He says, they'll rise and show signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. But take heed, see, I've told you these things beforehand. So that Jesus is giving his followers a heads up about what's going to happen, about what to prepare for. And if you think about it, the fact that they could get out of Jerusalem and escape all of this really helped the cause of Christianity to continue on and flourish through the end of the first century and on through the ages as it has. Disciples can be prepared because Jesus told them beforehand. That's the point. But then go on and look at Jesus' description of his coming in judgment against Jerusalem. He says, in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon shall not give its light. The stars of heaven will fall and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. If you're not used to prophetic language, and maybe haven't studied the Old Testament prophets, it may seem to you that Jesus is talking here about literally the sun and moon getting dark and problems in the cosmos, so to speak, and with the celestial bodies. But in reality, those are symbols. So the sun, moon, and stars are symbols of ruling powers. If you think about it, way back in the book of Genesis, the sun was created by God to rule the day, the Bible says. and the moon and stars were to rule the night. And so they become, in prophetic language, symbols of nations and rulers. And the idea is that there's going to be this huge shakeup among the nations when Jerusalem falls. And certainly Israel would no longer be a power. It would no longer be shining at all as a powerful light. This same language is used, as I said, in the prophecies of the Old Testament. Also, it's used in the book of Revelation to similar effect. Back in Isaiah, I'll just give you one example of this. In Isaiah 13, there's a prophecy about the fall of Babylon that was seen by Isaiah 13, chapter 13 and verse 1 says. Chapter 13 and verse 9, Isaiah describes it this way. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. Now, this is plainly, again, a prophecy. It's stated a prophecy about the destruction of Babylon, which was a foreign power that had conquered Jerusalem about 600 B.C. But the point is, this same language is used by the prophets at other times when there were great upheavals in world governments and shifting in power among the nations. What would happen when these events occurred is that Jesus' power and glory would be clearly seen by those who understood certainly that it was his power that was accomplishing these things. He says, then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. He will send his angels and gather together his elect to the four winds from the farthest part of the earth to the farthest part of heaven. This language may seem like it's talking about the end of time, but really, I believe it's talking about just the gathering together of God's truly chosen people, no longer the Jews, but Christians who would be gathered by him, protected, kept safe, in contrast to Israel, whom the Lord judged at the destruction of Jerusalem. The idea of the Lord coming in judgment is, again, prophetic language used frequently in the Old Testament to describe the destruction of a city or the destruction of a nation when God would come upon people in temporal judgment, and then his power and glory would have to be acknowledged as a consequence of that. And I believe that same sort of thing is being prophesied here concerning the destruction of Jerusalem. So we go on, and this is a painting, a famous painting done by Hayez of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. It's probably not very accurate, but it does sort of give you a feel for the tragedy of it all. This is a picture taken by Farrell Jenkins of some stones that were uncovered in 1967 in some work that was being done around the temple precinct. These stones appear to have come from the first century and had to have been cast down from above, so to speak. And it's widely believed that they're the broken stones, one not laying, you know, set on top of another any longer. And they're the size and at the place where you'd expect those stones to be. So it's interesting, impressive archaeological information that we get seeing those stones. In fact, that this prophecy of Jesus did come true in great detail, demonstrates him to be exactly who he said he was, the Son of God and the Christ of God, the one to become King of God's people. So we continue on in Mark chapter 13, then we come to verse 28. And Jesus says, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things happening, know that it is near, at the doors. You know, you can look at a tree and it's beginning to bud, and you know, well, it must be warming up. Summer is coming on. That's what Jesus is saying here. He says, assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. This is a critical turning point in Mark chapter 13. It's a critical turning point in Jesus' discussion. Here he's saying, everything that I've said so far is going to happen in this generation. That's one reason we know that the previous statements were not talking about the end of time. Obviously, time didn't end in that generation. So everything that Jesus prophesied up to that point is going to happen in that generation. But verse 31, Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So Jesus' words are going to remain forever. That generation is going to see the fulfillment of those words. And then notice in verse 32, here's the critical turn from verse 30 to 32. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. None but the Father knows the day or the hour when heaven and earth will pass away. You know, there are people running around today saying, oh, the end is near, and we can tell by the signs that Jesus is coming and the end of the world is near. Well, Jesus said he didn't even know. I don't know how people today think they can know. Only the Father knows that, and he's not telling, okay? He hasn't told us when that's going to happen. None but the Father know that day or hour. And the reason for it is so that we might be prepared. I mean, Jesus uses this illustration multiple times, or ones like it, where if we knew when he was to return, we'd wait until, you know, the day before, and then we'd get ourselves ready. But we don't know, so we have to be ready all the time. Listen to this illustration. He says, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Take heed and watch and pray, for you do not know when the time is. It is like a man going to a far country who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to each his work and commanded the doorkeeper to watch. Watch therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming. In the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say to you all, watch. Jesus is saying, you don't know when the end of the world is going to happen. You don't know when the second coming is going to be. So you be watchful for that. You be ready for it no matter what. And of course, that sentiment is echoed in other passages in the New Testament. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 tells us that it will come as a thief in the night. And there again, the Apostle Paul tells us to watch and be sober and be prepared. So that brings us to the end of chapter 13. And we open up chapter 14 of the Gospel of Mark. The text says, after 2 days, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him by trickery and put him to death. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar of the people. In the picture that you see on the screen, there's a gathering of Jews during a festival time in modern times. You see thousands of people crowded into this area below what used to be where the temple was, at the western wall. This is just a small sampling of what it would have been like during the Passover in Jesus' day. Again, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews, maybe well over a million, pressed into this very small area, shoulder to shoulder. I mean, if it were an aquarium and there were fish in it, they'd have to take turns swimming. That's how compacted they were. So these people, crowds, many of them adoring Jesus, and the leaders of the Jews don't want to take Jesus during this time. They're concerned about creating an uproar with so many people being in the city who love Jesus and who were loving the teaching that he was doing. So they're going to seek a time away from the crowds when they can take him down. The text also has just told us that, or tells us in verse 3, that Jesus would be in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. Well, again, Bethany is where he's been staying during this week, where he's been coming into the temple area and teaching and interacting with the leaders of the Jews and others, and then going back out and spending the nights in Bethany. So again, he's at the house of Simon the leper in Bethany, not too far outside the walls of Jerusalem. And then we open up in verse 3, and it says, being in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, he sat at the table, and a woman having an alabaster flask of very costly oil of spikenard, she broke the flask and poured it on his head. But there were some who were indignant among themselves and said, why was this fragrant oil wasted? For it might have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor. And they criticized her. So Jesus is here sitting at table, and this woman comes and anoints him with this flask of very costly oil. According to John's gospel, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were also there, and it was Mary, according to John's gospel, who was the one who anointed Jesus. Again, the observers criticized Mary. in John's gospel tells us that Judas took the lead in that. They said that she had wasted the oil. The oil could have been sold again for 300 denarii. A denarius was one day's wages for a working man. So 300 denarii would be an entire year's wages for a working man. You might wonder, how could a flask of oil possibly be that expensive? Well, oil of spikenard comes from a plant that only grows in the Himalayas at a pretty high elevation. And the oil is distilled, I believe, from the root of that plant. You can imagine back in Jesus' day, you have a plant that's up in the Himalayas and somebody takes the time to distill the oil out of it. And then it's got to be put on a camel or something and brought all the way to Jerusalem. Can you imagine the labor cost that's involved in that besides the oil itself? So again, a year's wages wouldn't be out of the question for a good sized flask of this oil. It was costly, and yet Mary anoints Jesus with it. Jesus does not allow her to be rebuked and criticized. It says in verse 6, Jesus says, "Let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She's done a good work for me. For you have the poor with you always, and whenever you wish, you may do them good. But me you do not have always. She has done what she could. She's come beforehand to anoint my body for burial. Assuredly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her." So Jesus' death is impending, just a very few days away. And Jesus has been talking about this. And I'm not sure if Mary knew for sure that he was going to die this week. He'd said it before this time. Whether or not that's the case, Jesus says, "She's anointed me for my burial. She's shown love for me in this great way before I'm put in the ground." He says, "The poor you have with you always, but you won't always have this opportunity to show this kind of love for me." So you have to appreciate what she did. And in fact, everywhere the gospel is spoken, this great story about her doing this is told. But at this point, we read about the tide really beginning to turn, so to speak. Judas goes to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. In verse 11, when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money, so he sought how he might conveniently betray him. Judas' actions here probably are connected to a couple of things. The priests and the leaders of the Jews had already become very incensed against Jesus and were seeking to kill him already. And then Judas, John's gospel tells us, was a thief. He used to keep the money bag for the disciples and he would take out of it for himself. So he's got a love for money that's working on him. And between those things and maybe who knows what else was going on in his heart, but he goes and makes a bargain with the leaders of the Jews to betray Jesus. The chief priests were glad and they promised to give Judas money to betray Jesus. You remember, Jesus had been in the temple a lot those previous days. He'd caused disturbances. He had exposed the Jewish leaders for the hypocrites that they were. And so they didn't like him at all, to say the least, and were very interested in getting him out of the way and squashing his burgeoning popularity among the people. We come then to verse 12 of Mark 14. On the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go and prepare that you may eat the Passover?" And he sent out two of his disciples and said to them, "Go into the city and a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him." So he gives them these instructions. Find this man carrying this water. You follow him. Where he goes in, tell the master of the house that the teacher asked where the guest room is for he and his disciples to eat the Passover. And then he'll show them this large furnished room and there they might eat the Passover. So all of that, whether by previous arrangement or more likely by some miracle, is arranged and the disciples get ready to eat that Passover and have what is popularly known as the Last Supper. In verse 18, as they said in 8, Jesus said, "Assuredly I say to you, one of you who eats with me will betray me." Now Jesus had intimated at this earlier in his ministry But here he says it plainly that one of them would betray him. They begin to be sorrowful and say to him, one by one, "Is it I?" And another said, "Is it I?" He answered and said to them, "It is one of the 12 who dips with me in the dish." So he knew that one of them sitting there, he knew who it was. The other disciples apparently did not. They wondered if each one wondered if he himself might be the one who betrays. But Jesus is letting them know that he knew that one of them would do that. This is an important facet of this story, because if the Son of Man and the Son of God, the King to come, if he could be tricked and deceived by one of his disciples without him knowing about it, you know, he wouldn't really be the all-knowing Son of God, would he? So this indicates that he knew what was happening all along. He even knew who was going to do it, which of them would do it. And other gospel accounts make this even clearer, but Jesus is well aware of what's about to happen. So as they're eating the Passover in verse 22, Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took the cup. When he'd given thanks, he gave it to them, and they drank, and they all drank from it. And he said to them, "This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many. Assuredly, I say to you, I will no longer drink of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." So he takes this cup and he gives thanks. He gives it to them. They drank. He says, "This is the blood of the new covenant. Here's what this is all about. I'm going to shed my blood, and it's going to be the blood that ratifies this new covenant, which is really the relationship that we can now have with God through the blood of Jesus Christ. It does away with that old covenant, the Jewish covenant given to the Israelites on Mount Sinai. It does away with that. We'll replace that. What was promised in Jeremiah chapter 31 in the Old Testament, this new covenant, this is the blood of that covenant which is shed for many. And he also tells them to take the bread and eat. And it was his body. Jesus thus institutes this ongoing Memorial Day. We have Memorial Day coming up where we remember some of our country who have passed on. Jesus wants us to remember him. And he does so by instituting this memorial. We might remember people who have passed on because we erected monuments to them or because of a gravestone or something like that. But we remember Jesus in a living way by, on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, taking the cup and the bread, and remembering him from that. He took the bread first, then the cup. If I wasn't clear about that, I went through that really quick, and then instituted the supper. In verse 26 now, the text says, when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Interesting that they sing a hymn together. Jesus does with his disciples on this occasion. Would have been interesting to know what hymn it was and how it sounded. But they go out, they sing this hymn, they go across the Kidron Valley and up to the Mount of Olives. This is a view of the Kidron Valley. The temple would have been up on the right there, where you see that wall. Back up behind to the left would be where they'd go up to the Mount of Olives. The Passover lambs were being sacrificed in the temple, and the blood from those lambs would run out a conduit out the back of the temple and down through this valley. A brook ran through that valley in that day and time. And, you know, Jesus is actually coming through the blood of the Passover lambs, he himself being the Lamb of God, as he goes up to the Mount of Olives. We come then to Mark 14 and verse 27. Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, as it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Even if all are made to stumble, I will not be." Jesus is quoting from Zechariah when he says, you know, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And he knows that they're going to scatter. He knows that they will not be with him to the end. Peter says, no, that's not going to be the case with me. He objects. He would not stumble even if all of the rest of them did. He was apparently overconfident, wasn't he? The Bible tells us, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Jesus says to him, "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But Peter spoke more vehemently, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And of course, they all said the same thing. Jesus goes on, and they come to a place that's called Gethsemane, and he tells his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took Peter, James, and John with him and began to be troubled and deeply distressed. So here is the area where the Garden of Gethsemane would have been on the Mount of Olives. This is an olive tree, a very ancient tree that is there on the Mount of Olives. It goes back to Roman times. It's not quite back to the time of Christ, but it's a very ancient tree, and there are some others there that are very old. So you can just sort of picture a garden, a lot of olive trees around there. The word Gethsemane means olive press, so this would be a place not only where olives grew, but where they were pressed. And so Jesus instructs his disciples to sit and wait, and he takes Peter, James, and John with him, and he goes, and he begins to be overwhelmed with grief, deeply troubled and distressed, it says in verse 33. And he says to them in verse 34, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch." So he leaves them there, and he goes a little farther and falls to the ground and prays that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. Jesus knows what is coming. He knows the excruciating agony that he's going to have to face in being crucified on a cross. But even more so, he knows the weight that he's going to have to bear as he gives himself up for all the sins of mankind. And the weight of that, I'm sure, bore heavily upon him. Here he is, the innocent Son of God, the Lamb of God, giving himself under such extreme duress for the sins of the world. He prays that the hour might pass. In verse 36, he calls upon God as Abba, Father, Abba being a term of endearment for a father. "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will." And in praying this prayer, Jesus shows us how we ought to pray in times of great distress. Maybe we're about to have to go through something that we have to go through. We don't want to do it. Maybe it's not going to be pleasant, but for the Lord's sake, we need to do it. We can pray like Jesus prayed. He wasn't looking forward to all of this, but he did want to do the Father's will no matter what. And the Father's will was more important than his own. We see that throughout. Jesus returns and he finds the three disciples sleeping. And he says to Peter, "Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray lest you enter temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak." Twice more, the Lord goes and prays. He prays fervently these same words. He comes back and he finds the three disciples asleep. The third time, he asked them in verse 41, "Are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." So he tells them, this is the time. They couldn't stay awake. It was late at night, probably after midnight or thereabouts. They'd been through a long day. It had been a long week of teaching, listening to Jesus, being with him. Lots of things going on, and indeed the flesh was weak, and they fell asleep. But now the time had come, and he roused them as Judas arrives with the armed mob sent from the leaders of the Jews. Verse 43, immediately while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came with a multitude with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. His betrayer had given them a signal, "Whomever I kiss, he's the one. Seize him and lead him away." So Judas identifies Jesus with a kiss. And as soon as he had come, immediately he went up to him and said to him, "Rabbi, Rabbi," and he kissed him. And they laid their hands on him and they took him. At that point in verse 47, one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Probably intended to kill him, probably intending him to take his head off. But he slices his ear off, and we find in John's gospel that the disciple that did that was Peter. The name of the high priest's servant was a man named Malchus. Luke records at this juncture that Jesus healed the ear of the high priest's servant. He's the only gospel writer that records that. But you see this very tense moment. Peter's ready to fight these men, probably wouldn't have lasted very long against such a mob, but Jesus is not willing for that to happen on this occasion. And so he says in verse 48, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me?" He says, "I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me, but the scriptures must be fulfilled." So he notes, first of all, their cowardice and hypocrisy. They could have arrested Jesus any time if they wanted to do so lawfully. But here they are in the dead of night, not with any, you know, witnesses around, from the Jews in Jerusalem at least. Here only with his disciples, and they come to arrest him really only because of their hatred of him, not because of any true crimes that he's committed. The scriptures, though, had to be fulfilled. All of this is happening in fulfillment of God's will and God's word. So at that point, indeed, they all forsake Jesus and flee. And it says in verse 51 that a certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body. And the young man laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. This is an interesting little tidbit that's put in here. You can picture maybe a young man who'd gotten up at night and threw his blanket around him and kind of following along, seeing what was going on. And some of the other people in the mob want to grab him, lay hold of him at this point, and they get a hold of the cloth that's around him, and he runs out of it and runs out into the night. We wonder why this is included here. Again, it's interesting a little bit on its own, in its own right. It may indicate just the interest of this mob of people to get a hold of somebody, anybody, and do them harm. But others have conjectured perhaps that it was Mark who wrote this epistle that was this young man. He probably would have been a young man living in Jerusalem about this time. We know his mother had a house there, so that could be the case, but we're not sure. In any case, Jesus is taken from that point away to the high priest. Farrell Jenkins took this picture of these stone steps, ancient steps in Jerusalem, leading up to Jerusalem. And he said about them, he said, "Jesus would observe the Passover and instituted the Lord's Supper in the upper city. He then went with his disciples to Gethsemane. From there, he's taken to the house of Caiaphas," or Caiaphas. Jesus may have taken these steps in both directions. And that's an interesting bit of archaeology there to me, that those could be the very steps which Jesus went back into the city on. But they come to the palace of the high priest, and here's a picture of a model of that palace, and gives you kind of an idea of what it might have been like. It's really more of a compound, several residences there, several different courtyards, porticos around. This model is, I think, probably very accurate. If it's not exactly like it, which I wouldn't expect it to be, it would be nonetheless very close to the kind of thing that that Jesus would have been taken to, and where his Jewish trial would have taken place. So they lead him in there, and it says in verse 53, they led him there, and there were assembled all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes. So the Sanhedrin was made up of the chief priests and about 23 of Jewish elders and about 23 scribes. There were 70 all in the Sanhedrin, according to some ancient scholars. So in any case, whether this was the whole Sanhedrin, probably not, but a good portion of them were there, these very leaders of the Jews. Peter follows from afar off at a distance and comes into the courtyard of the high priest, and he sat with the servants and warmed himself at a fire. So it was a cold night, according to John's gospel. There's a fire there. Peter sits right with the servants of the high priest, the enemies of Christ who've just come and arrested Jesus. And so now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. So they're trying to get some sort of testimony. They've arrested him. They really don't have anything to arrest him for. So now they have to trump up some charges against him that are make him worthy of death. It says that many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. So all sorts of people are willing to say bad things about Jesus, but their testimonies don't agree together. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands. Within 3 days, I will build another made without hands. But not even then did their testimony agree. Of course, they're trying to twist Jesus' words. He, at one time, had talked about the temple of his body being destroyed and, you know, coming back to life, being built again after 3 days, talking about his resurrection. They tried to twist those words to him claiming that he was going to destroy the physical temple in Jerusalem. In verse 60, the text says that the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" But he kept silent and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him, saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And at that point, Jesus says, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." So Jesus acknowledges being the Christ, the Son of God, and that he, in fact, would come again. And this priest would see him sitting in the clouds at the right hand of God. At that point, the high priest, believing that, or at least acting like he believed that Jesus had committed blasphemy, says, he tears his clothes and he says, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You've heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" They all condemned him to be deserving of death. Some begin to spit on him and blindfold him and beat him and say to us, "Prophesy." And the officers struck him with the palm of their hands. So here's where the physical abuse of Jesus begins. He'll endure some long time of this from the Jews. He'll be taken to the Romans and endure multiple rounds of this with them. So he's already, you know, think about it, been up for much longer than a day already, much longer than 24 hours, and it's going to be much longer than that before all of this is over. Before all this is finished, it'll be much longer than 24 hours before he passes away on the cross. Here we're told the end of Peter's saga with him denying the Lord as Jesus said he would and as Peter had vehemently denied that he would. So we pick up the reading in verse 66. And it says that Peter was below in the courtyard, and one of the servant girls of the high priest came. She saw Peter warming himself. She looked at him, and she said, "You also were with Jesus of Nazareth." He denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you were saying." And he went out on the porch, and a rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, "This is one of them." But he denied it again. And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter again, "Surely you are one of them, for you are Galilean. Your speech shows it." You know, sometimes your accent can tell where you can tell where you're from by your accent. If you from Alabama, folks from around here travel up north somewhere, a lot of times people can guess you're from Alabama. Somebody from Michigan or Wisconsin travels down here, a lot of times we can guess where they're from. So Peter was a Galilean. He wasn't from around the area of Judea and Jerusalem, and his speech was a little different. And so they were able to identify him by his speech, probably by his appearance. The servant girl recognized him, and yet Peter still denies it. He says, "I do not know this man." The rooster crows then, and Peter remembers what Jesus had said. And the text says that he went, when he thought about it, he wept. Overconfidence is a terrible thing. We think we are capable of doing something. We're self-assured. We're maybe prideful. We think we have more commitment than we do. We think the trial is not going to be as difficult as it will be. And so with those factors, you know, Peter failed the test on this occasion, as Jesus said he would. This was very bitter to Peter, and of course it took something for him to overcome it eventually and to truly follow Christ after his resurrection and become the great apostle that he did become. But it's a cautionary tale, a cautionary lesson for all of us. Let's remember that we need Christ, that trials can be difficult. Let's remember that the world will pressure us intensely, just like Peter was pressured here, and we must recognize what they're doing. We need to try to keep ourselves out of situations where we'll be under that kind of intense pressure from the world so that we might keep our faith and faithfulness in Jesus Christ. Well, we thank you for following along tonight. This was the longest section by far of the Gospel of Mark that we've covered. 37 verses, I think, in Mark 13 and 72 in Mark 14. That's a lot of verses to cover in one lesson. Thank you for bearing with me as I try to get through this in a hurry. I want to remind you that you can go to our website, eastside-church.org, and sign up for the Mark Correspondence Course, as well as look at other things of interest there. We have a lot of Bible lessons on video, Bible study materials. You can contact the elders or myself. Our emails are there on the website, so feel free to do that. And be with us again next week as we conclude this series of studies, studying the last two chapters in the Gospel of Mark.